looking for that perfect Christmas gift for the family? Why not a chicken? Stick a bow on top, put the chicken under the tree, and who knows, you may even have a couple eggs to fry up for breakfast Christmas morning. Give the gift that keeps on clucking. A chicken. Okay, maybe it's not the perfect gift for your family, but it is the perfect gift for a poor family in Asia. A chicken can break the cycle of poverty for a poor family. Yes, a chicken. A chicken's eggs provide food and nourishment for a family, and they can sell those eggs at the market for income. When you donate a chicken or any other animal through Gospel for Asia, 100% of what you give goes to the field. And the best gift of all, when Gospel for Asia gives a poor family an animal, it opens the door to the love of Jesus. So give the perfect gift for a family in Asia this Christmas. Give them a chicken. Call 866-WIN-ASIA. Or to see chickens and other animals to donate, go to CritterCampaign.org.
Welcome to Hope for the Caregiver. I am Peter Rosenberger. This is the nation's number one show for you as a family caregiver. How are you doing? How are you holding up? What's going on with you? This show is dedicated to those who are willingly, knowingly, voluntarily, without pay, for those of you in McDuncan, putting themselves between a vulnerable loved one and even worse disaster. Whether that loved one has Alzheimer's or autism or addiction or Parkinson's or cerebral palsy or a traumatic brain injury, whatever the issue, there's always a caregiver. And this show focuses on that individual. There are more than 65 million of us in this country alone, and I believe the numbers are growing. And in the age of coronavirus, that's kind of changed the whole concept of caregiving, hasn't it? We're even afraid to send our loved ones to places because we're afraid that may be the last time we ever see them. And so there are a lot of dynamics going on with the family caregiver. And we dedicate this show to you as a family caregiver. If you want to be a part of the show, the number to call is 877. Oh, for heaven's sakes, Ed, what is that number? 877-655-6755. I'm serious. Look,
I was going to say I've got it memorized. Yeah.
Well, then you should have said it. I mean, yes, jump in there. Help
you haven't
a man
even introduced
out.
Me yet? You know,
I've been a caregiver for 34 years. Look what it did to me, man. I mean, I can't even think straight. That's John Butler, the Count of Mighty Disco. You know him, you love him. You've gotten postcards from him. He's the guy that has been with me from the very beginning of this show, producing the show, a steady hand on the till when I'm asleep at the bottom of the boat.
Well, thank you.
He takes
so much
the night
for that
shift.
One. Absolutely take that. Oh yeah, I'm getting third watch, guys. That's all there is. But yes, no. Thank you for the intro, Peter. And it is a
such that it
really.
Is.
Yeah. It is an incredible privilege to be involved with something that, like you said, there's 65 million caregivers out there, and that's a really is a big number for a rather overlooked demographic. And that's
it
one
is,
of the reasons I,
and,
yeah, yeah. I was so going to say, we ended up getting paired together way back when, and they said, oh, it's a show for caregivers. I'm like, well, that makes sense, but let's see how this goes. And, and lo it went.
And we became the first radio program to ever go syndication that you had produced. I don't know. How many shows have you produced in your life, in your career?
Over 100 different, not like individual shows, but like shows that went for, you know, several months or a couple of years or something like that, but several hundred radio programs. And this was the first one that really went to syndication because there is this huge need.
And said that all the others said they were going to, but none of them ever did.
Yeah. And this, well, it's a lot like, you always have outliers
Who you calling a liar?
Hey,
I reason.
Oh, hey. Speaking of which, you know what you call a chicken looking at a bowl of lettuce? It's a chicken Caesar salad.
Oh, John does a dad joke every week for whatever reason. I have no idea. But no,
I got a big database of jokes. You know.
So. Yes, you do. And but you've been with us. We developed this show, and now we've become the number one broadcast show for family caregivers. And then our podcast, which today's episode is also the number one podcast for family caregivers in the world. And for that, I'm very grateful. We know there's an audience. We know there's this just huge amount of people, and we want to make things available. Given that, we had on several months ago a wonderful author, speaker. She wrote a book called The Opposite of Certainty, and Janine Urbanek-Reed. And I was so fascinated by our discussion, and I wanted to have her back on. So I reached back out to her people and to her and said, look, can you come back on and let us open this up a little bit more and explore what she had to offer? Because one of the passions I have for this show is to find people who bring such depth and wisdom and insight to the conversation. And then collectively, we all get stronger by having that. And I was fascinated by her, and she had a line, because we talked about her faith through this, and she had a line that I loved, and it was, my faith used to be like a AAA card I kept in my wallet to be used in emergencies until, you know, and I thought that was such a great line. My faith used to be like a AAA card. And I just thought that was great. So Janine, welcome back to the show, and thank you for taking the time to be a part of this today.
Thank you, Peter. It's my pleasure. And it's just so important what you're doing. I was contemplating that before I called in, and I was thinking of how isolated I felt at times as a caregiver, even among my friends who were going through their daily life. And this is so valuable. You're providing this place where we can connect with other people who know, you know, other people who are, we don't know, we can't see them, but we know they're nodding their heads as they're listening.
Well, and I see the numbers of people that are downloading what we do here, and then I know the audience on my broadcast show, how big that is. And yes, you're right. We'll never see the people, but I know that the need is great, and that brings me to your journey. Before we get into your specific journey, would you just kind of set the table of who you are and what you do, and then we're going to get into kind of where this has gone with you as a caregiver and as someone who's also been caregived for, if that's the problem. How did I say that,
like,
Josh?
Caregiver.
Is that the past perfect?
No, it's the caregiving.
Caregiven. Yeah, something
yeah,
like
the
that. Yeah.
The caregiven. Oh, the caregiven. Oh, I like that one better. The caregiven. Yeah.
Well, you know, I like to say that my life philosophy was very simple. I just wanted to try to do everything right, you know, and I'm a mother of three children who are now young adults. They're in their early 20s now. And, you know, I grew up in alcoholism. And I say this because, you know, all of these experiences of my life set this table of who I would become and what faith would look like, which, of course, was my that faith was that strength, was that muscle that got me through absolutely everything in my life. And so I grew up in alcoholism with two very lovely, very young and parents. And my dad drank and my mom took care of him. And we just tried to keep things as normal as possible. And there was this idea that if we could keep the outside straight, you know, if we ironed our leotards in the 80s, I mean, we were very put together, you know. We had the nice garden in the neighborhood. If we could keep the outside straight, the insides would come along. And, you know, what happened in our family is my dad eventually got sober, and we learned about alcoholism. We all started getting better. And, you know, that's how I set this. So this is the setting the stage for how I became a mother. You know, I tried to do in my life too, you know, everything right, check that box. And I had my first baby when I was 30. And again, I'm going to study up. I am going to keep this child safe because, you know, while my parents were looking the other way when I was growing up, some really funky abusive stuff happened with some other family members, and I was just vowed nothing would, no one would hurt my kids. So, you know, it went, I was very stressed out, as we get.
Perfection is a cruel taskmaster, isn't it?
Exactly.
I was going to say motherhood is a cruel taskmaster. Well,
oh, yeah. Yeah, and that love we feel, it's so real and it's so genuine, and we just want to keep these people safe. And what I came to find out, you know, I had three children, you know, and a period of 5 years, again, very nicely spaced, doing it all very well and taking care and, you know, really praying and trying to be of service in the world, trying to be a really good person. And what happened is my young son, my son Mason, who's my middle child, his hand began to shake about kindergarten. And we started this journey, which you'll relate to, you know, you start the journey of like what's going on. And seeing various doctors and being told, you know, this is a normal tremor and he has migraine headaches, adjust his diet. And being the, you know, the good mom, I'm making air quotes, but I was a good mom. We are good moms. You know, anybody listening right to this show is a good mom. You're trying so hard. But being a good mom, you know, that was good news for me. Okay, diet. I can do diet. I can control the diet. And then what eventually happened is my son Mason was diagnosed. He was about 10 years old, when he was diagnosed with an inoperable, slow-growing brain tumor. So what that meant was, I say that our family entered the orbit of this brain tumor. And for me, you know, my spiritual journey, you know, I skipped over the part where I, you know, developed alcoholism myself and got sober when I was 24. You know, I was 6 years sober when my oldest son was born. And I had a faith, you know, and I had a faith that if I did everything right, you know, it was like the I guess a cash register kind of thing in a way. You know, I don't want to minimize that. I was so sincere in my faith, but there were limitations. And this experience with my son forced me to go deeper and to let go of a lot of platitudes.
Let me jump in two things. One of them is I started adding family members of alcoholics and addicts to this audience as caregivers, because I felt like wherever there's a chronic disease, there's a chronic impairment, and alcoholism is. It's a chronic disease. You have to work a recovery program. And wherever there is a chronic impairment, there's a caregiver. And so how do you feel about that as somebody who was in a relationship with an alcoholic
and then, yeah,
somebody that also wrestled with that themselves? How does that make you? I'm not going to hang up on you if you disagree with this.
No. I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And it takes a lot of the shame out of this, because it's one of the reasons that I think alcoholism is so hidden, is it's this big secret. And it's for a caregiver of an alcoholic to come out and get help for somebody. And we don't say, oh, your loved one is a bad person. We go, oh, he's a sick person. Well, we can deal with a sick person, you know. And then, you know, I had to get help. That's how I ended up starting my sobriety journey, is I got help as a child of an alcoholic, which was another test. I think there was like it was before there was online. I'm sure it's online now, but there was like a list of characteristics of children of alcoholics. And if you've just listened to my introduction, you could fill it out for me. I've, you know, perfectionism, this drive to control, you know, all of these things. I found myself, my life had been shaped by the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, it's the good news and the bad news, because some of these qualities aren't awful in moderation.
Exactly. And that's, yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that, you know, we have these common qualities that are coping mechanisms, but then they can be very, very useful in lots of situations. But then
Become extremely valuable. I often tell this to people about caregivers. We are an employer's dream. We're highly adaptable, flexible. We try to get so many things done. We're constantly putting out the fires and stepping up and doing things, and that becomes a part of our DNA. And it's hard to change a behavior that you're getting rewarded for.
Well, exactly, exactly. And but there's that moment, like on the head of a pin, that moment where it tips, and that's that moment where, as I was listening to you, Peter, I thought about, and I will stay late, and I will be up at 2 a.m. taking notes about how things should be, and I will drive myself into the ground. And that's where the downside of that goes, and that's where the support is so important.
Well, we're talking with Janine Urbanek-Reed, and she's got a new book out called The Opposite of Certainty. And John and I were just enthralled with her several months ago when she was on the show, and wanted to have her back on to explore this a little bit further. I mean, we're getting into the meat of where caregivers live. We've got all these issues going on, whether it's a child with issues, whether it's a parent that's an alcoholic, all these kinds of things. There's always a caregiver, and that caregiver develops his or her own challenges to go along with it. We're going to talk about that more. Don't go away. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll be right back.
Have you ever struggled to trust God when lousy things happen to you? I'm Gracie Rosenberger, and in 1983, I experienced a horrific car accident leading to 80 surgeries and both legs amputated. I questioned why God allowed something so brutal to happen to me. But over time, my questions changed, and I discovered courage to trust God. That understanding, along with an appreciation for quality prosthetic limbs, led me to establish Standing with Hope. For more than a dozen years, we've been working with the government of Ghana and West Africa, equipping and training local workers to build and maintain quality prosthetic limbs for their own people. On a regular basis, we purchase and ship equipment and supplies, and with the help of inmates in a Tennessee prison, we also recycle parts from donated limbs. All of this is to point others to Christ, the source of my hope and strength. Please visit standingwithhope.com to learn more and participate in lifting others up. That's standingwithhope.com. I'm Gracie, and I am Standing with Hope.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the nation's number one show for you as a family caregiver. That's my wife, Gracie, on her new CD, Resilient, and she is indeed resilient. And boy, she can sing, too. If you want a copy of that, go out to hopeforthecaregiver.com, and you'll see the album cover right there on the front. Just click on it. And for any tax-deductible contribution to what we're doing here, no matter what the amount, we'll send you a copy of that CD. How about that? It's a pretty good deal. So go to hopeforthecaregiver.com. We're talking with Janine Urbanek-Reed. Her new book is called The Opposite of Certainty, and she's sharing her journey. All right, so let me sum up. You grew up in an alcoholic family, a family member with an alcoholic, mm-hmm. who did get sober, and, mm-hmm. and for that, that is great news. Along the way, though, it led you into some uncomfortable places where you had to walk through your own sobriety, but you did that. Then you're going along and being a great mom and all these kind of things, and all of a sudden you find out your son, your middle son, has a brain tumor. Things get a little bit weird from there on out, don't they?
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah, they did get a little bit weird. Yeah, I like to say it's like we didn't get pushed off the beaten path. It's like we went up a goat trail up the back of the mountain. You know, we're not on the alternative path. And many of you can relate to that, right? Where it's like we're charting our own course day by day. So what happened, my son is now 23. So I want to take everybody can inhale. He has been living with this. We've all been living with this tumor that acts up from time to time. And we originally, you know, we sought out a great medical team, and that was a lesson in and of itself because we had, as many people can relate to, you know, some false starts there. And we eventually found a team that would work with us, right, that respected me as a mother, we could discuss things, which was so important because no one knows our children as we do, you know, but I don't know the medicine behind brain tumors. So that partnership was essential, and we still have the same partnership, the same doctors all these years later. And what happened is eventually, 3 years in, we were living this uneasy peace with Mason's tumor, where he would go to school and try to get out of work by saying, well, I have a brain tumor. What's your problem? And people, we'd have to tell people it's okay to laugh. He's just giving you a hard time. I coached his middle school teachers. Don't let him get away with that.
Hold that thought right there. How important was a sense of humor for your family through this?
Oh, Peter, you're just...
Absolutely. It was everything. And I, you know, this kid of mine, talk about a gift from God. He is hilarious. And he has this dry sense of humor. And, you know, how many funny sitcoms we just watched and we joked, you know. I came across a line I meant to put in the book where I was driving Mason to school, and I looked in the mirror and I said, oh, shoot, I forgot to put makeup on. And he said, and all caregivers can relate to this too, right? I forgot to brush my teeth.
Particularly John, but that's a different story.
Yeah, right.
Hey.
Yeah, John, we'll get to that next. But, anyways,
that's a whole different show.
But I said, that, oh, and Mason said, oh, Mom, you don't need makeup. You don't need makeup. A little floss, maybe, but no makeup.
A little floss, maybe.
You know,
Is Mason my mother?
That's rough, man.
He's, and that was his engagement, you know, and he has a lot of self-awareness too. At this point, you know, he's 23 and he's able to say, you know, I use that as a coping mechanism. And I said, I know. It's okay. You know,
There are worse coping mechanisms, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. There really are.
We talk about on this show the importance of laughter an awful lot, and it can... I mentioned this to Peter like a year ago, and I don't know if you remember it or not, but laughter is like windshield wipers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't stop the rain, but they let you get through it.
I love that. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah.
It's another John Butlerism.
And I
say this often on the show because it's worth repeating. I remember when I first started looking at doing the show, and people were kind of thinking, you know, what's this show about caregivers, all this kind of stuff? And this is before I even went to John and worked with him on it. But Jeff Foxworthy told me, he said, Peter, make them laugh. You more than most know how painful this journey is, and they've got to laugh. They, you know, one of my favorite quotes is by Barry Manilow, is that, you know, I'm not here to cure cancer, but I can make you forget about it for about an hour and a half.
Mm.
And so when you get out there and you participate in music and laughter and life, you know, everybody's got sadness. Everybody's got heartache. And we don't have to be miserable, though. I mean, Gracie's got a wicked sense of humor. And she laughs like a drunk Viking. I mean, she does. I mean, you get her laughing. I mean, we have sitting at lunch today with her parents and Gracie, and she's just, you know, blah, ha, ha, you know, kind of thing. I mean, she's missing both legs. She's in pain all the time, 80 surgeries, all the things that are going on with her. And, you know, she does. So I'm glad to hear that Mason has got that kind of sense of humor about it. And yeah, I get the coping mechanism part of it. But you know what? We could laugh and learn to laugh and see funny things in it, or we can just be mean and bitter. And that's no way to live. So,
exactly.
Yeah, that's kudos to him. You tell him kudos, because that's a great – and you too. You got a great sense of humor too.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. Oh, and we've got a big dog here too. I don't know if you can hear him.
No, let him bark. Okay, we don't care.
Yeah. Good. Well, yeah. So, you know, in telling you my story, so what happened, there was a turning point where everything changed. Because up until Mason was 13, he was this normal kid who, by the way, had a tumor in his head, you know, and would have headaches. And there were these small bleeds in his tumor. So these, you know, emergency runs to the hospital. But nothing was ever... We managed somehow, you know, and then when Mason was 13, he had a massive cerebral hemorrhage in his tumor, and he was in a coma and spent 6 months in the hospital, which is a big part of our story, because so much, this is my forced surrender. This is my, I thought I had a path for this child, and I knew what the right path was. God, don't you agree with me? Because why wouldn't you? This is a good path. We all agree this is a good path. He is safe. He gets a job. He's a nice contributing person to society. And, you know, my plans. And what happened is Mason spent his first eighth grade in in hospitals. You know, we went to Houston for rehab, spent a lot of time at Texas Children's Hospital. Big shout out there. Love Texas Children's.
Now, you guys live in California, though, right?
We live in Northern California, so that...
That was a commitment.
It was a commitment, and it was also, you know, the family really stretching because my other two kids were in school. So we had to leave. You know, I left them behind and could see them out on weekends, basically, from time to time. So it was very difficult.
Mm. We're talking with Janine Urbanek-Reed. And her book is called The Opposite of Certainty. And you could hear the challenges that she's dealt with. She and her family dealt with a mother's heart. But she wasn't dealing with just this challenge. We're going to get into that more after the break. We just got to take a quick break. Don't go away. This is Hope for the Caregiver. This is a show for you as a family caregiver about how you're feeling, how you're doing, the isolation you're fighting against. This is what we're going to speak to and continue to speak to. We'll be right back. Hey, this is Peter Rosenberger. Have you ever helped somebody walk for the first time? I've had that privilege many times through our organization, Standing with Hope. When my wife, Gracie, gave up both of her legs following this horrible wreck that she had as a teenager, and she tried to save them for years, and it just wouldn't work out, and finally she relinquished them and thought, wow, this is it. I mean, I don't have any legs anymore. What can God do with that? And then she had this vision for using prosthetic limbs as a means of sharing the gospel, to put legs on our fellow amputees, and that's what we've been doing now since 2005 with Standing with Hope. We work in the West African country of Ghana, and you can be a part of that through supplies, through supporting team members, through supporting the work that we're doing over there. You could designate a limb. There's all kinds of ways that you could be a part of giving the gift that keeps on walking at standingwithhope.com. Would you take a moment to go out to standingwithhope.com and see how you can give? They go walking and leaping and praising God. You can be a part of that at standingwithhope.com.
Are you enjoying our podcast? I'm John Butler, and I've helped produce Peter's show, Hope for the Caregiver, since it began. I'd like to think that I'm responsible for the explosive growth this show has enjoyed. I'd like to think that, but, well, Peter pays me not to, so let's move along. All jokes aside, though, Peter and I do have a great time with the show. We absolutely love it. In this podcast, we not only publish things from the show, but also include special bonus materials. We really don't want to have a subscription section, but would rather make all of this great content available for free to hurting caregivers. You can help us do that by clicking on the Become a Patron button. For as little as a dollar a month, you can be a part of the world's number one podcast for family caregivers. There's all types of gifts that we'd love to give you depending on what tier you'd like to join. Maybe it's $5, maybe it's $10, whatever you'd like. Consider sponsoring this podcast today and help strengthen family caregivers and yourself. Thanks so much, and remember, healthy caregivers make better caregivers.
You know, there's a lot of bumper music you could use for any of the shows, but when your wife sings that well, why not use hers? That's my wife, Gracie. I love listening to her sing. He knows the plans he has for you. Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the show for you as a family caregiver. We're talking with Janine Urbanek-Reed, and her journey is going to sound real familiar to so many of you listening right now. A mother who's watching her child go through something that she can't take away. But there's more. So Janine, just take us back to this. You're traveling back and forth to Texas. You're seeing your other children, you know, once a week, hopefully. And while you're down, they're in California, you're in Texas, and your son has a brain tumor. What's next? What happens next?
Well, you know, I guess what I'd say is I hit a bottom, you know, with my plans and designs. You know, I was holding out all this time for us just to nudge us over on that normal path, off the goat path, off the mountain, you know, which is so treacherous. Or one another way is, you know, I wanted the miracle to be that the tumor might magically disappear or just go on inactive, and that Mason could have the life that I saw his peers having, you know. And what I had to surrender to were a couple of things. One is that the miracles were all around me, right? So once I stopped looking at that far away, like this is not supposed to be happening, and I could be more present in those hospital rooms, right, and just be there and notice the miracle of the doctor who answered his own phone. I mean, we all know what that means. That doesn't happen, right? But it happened quite a few times for us, right? The doctor who answered his own phone, the nurse's aide who had just the perfect thing to say to me, the friend who's had the perfect words to say to me. So there was this shift of kind of coming back into focus. And so this is my path right now. You know, I think I was waiting to live a life I recognized, like, okay, I will get my life back and then we'll be okay. And we'll, in the meantime, we'll get through this. And there was this moment in Houston where I don't know what shifted or at what moment, but there was this moment where it shifted, where it was like, this is the life I've got. I got to start living it right now. So that meant seeing, you know, my friend Joan, a very close friend of mine, I would call her and she would ask me how I'd been cared for in any given day. And I call that God, you know, you can call it whatever you want. It's good. It's goodness in this world. And I couldn't deny the good in the story. I couldn't deny the good in any given day. And the other huge piece that happened in Houston was I really started taking care of myself. You know?
Let me ask you during that time, and this is another personal question, and feel free to just hang up on John, but it's did you feel a lot of caregivers go through an excessive weight gain period? Did that happen to you? It happened to me.
I tend to not be able to eat when I'm in, like, so you when go it's the opposite really direction. On, I can't eat.
Yeah. And yeah, this is something I've talked about with Peter a couple times, because I do the same thing. If I'm under stress, I just neglect everything.
It's a weight, regardless of what, it's a weight issue. We have a weight issue. We either lose weight because we're not taking care of ourselves, or we're gaining weight because we're not taking care of ourselves. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. And, you know, for me, food just physically tasted like dust in my mouth at times. It was the strangest experience I'd ever had. Yeah. But I did.
That is strange.
Isn't it strange? Yeah. There's probably some reason
for that. Because you were in the hospital setting, in a clinical setting?
No, I think it was the stress. Somehow the stress on my body. I don't know. It's a weird thing, but it just was, literally it was that thing where it's like, I can't eat. Now I did eat, and I did, I'm pretty good about that sort of thing, like keeping my blood sugar up and, you know, like as if I'm running a marathon or something. I'm pretty good about having protein bars in my purse. So the overeating, well, sugar is always a thing for me. So, you know, that's another show.
Yeah. I have a problem with chocolate. And the problem I have with chocolate is that I don't have all of the chocolate right now.
That makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I knew I had to make a change when I got so big I was leaving footprints in dry concrete. I mean, you know, that's when you know you've got to make some changes here. Yeah. So anyway, I digress on that. But I'm always curious. I have these hypotheses that I've put out there because I've watched it. I've tracked with so many caregivers. And I just like to every now and then just check and see, okay, here's a caregiver who went through a very stressful situation. What part did food play in it?
We've already touched on control. Tasteless. You know, we've already touched on control, and food can be a very triggering thing to, you know, someone. Like we want to, you know, exert some control over our lives when we might feel that we have none, and that can be a way that people do that. So it's something to keep an eye on.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, now, how about your fight with sobriety during this time?
You know, I.
this is personal and you don't have to answer.
Okay. It's totally, I wrote about it. I feel like if I wrote about it, I'm happy to talk about it because I think it's relevant, right? We want comfort.
Yeah.
And when I got sober, I'd gotten some good habits. And one of them was to have a circle of a support group. And, my friend Joan was a big part of my support group and my mentor for many years in sobriety. And I thank God that I had those relationships and those strong bonds, because that is what carried me in sobriety. And I knew, I knew that I couldn't do what I needed to do and drink, but it didn't even actually, the urge or the desire to drink didn't come up. It was more like, I just want off this planet. I don't really want to die, but I want there to be some other way where, like, I had this fantasy, like, I could get my family, like, we could all go somewhere, but I don't know where that is, where a brain tumor ceases to exist. But it was more like, I just want out, you know?
Mm. Did you stay around the clock at the hospital? Or did you have a separate room kind of thing? Or how did that work?
Well, we did my husband and I, when we were in Northern California, Mason was at Stanford Children's for 2 months of that, and we did switch off and take night shifts. And my parents were nearby, and this is also a miracle of sobriety story. My dad is one of my close people, and my mom is too. Mm. They're not married to each other anymore, but we took shifts with Mason. And when we went to Houston, it was a little tougher. And there was that moment, actually, the one I was talking about in Houston, where I was like, I've got to take care of myself. And that was when I stopped spending the night in the hospital. I mean, we were, I think, 4 months in, and I had to just physically leave and lay flat in a bed. They have these things, so-called sleeping chairs, which is great for hospital-wise, but, it's noisy.
Yeah, yes, it is. And, Let me deviate just a hair and talk to that individual who is spending the night at the hospital and then let them know kind of what was that trigger for you to say, okay, it's okay for me to go and go somewhere else and sleep.
I feel like I physically hit a wall, like the exhaustion. And there was a little voice in my head, which may have been sanity, saying, you can't keep this up. You cannot do for Mason what needs to be done and keep at this pace. So I'm, as this codependent person, another result of the alcoholism I grew up in, I'm aware that I'll do anything for my kids. I'll do anything for people I love. So when it came to, taking care of myself in this way is for the greater good, that's when I was able to make the shift. Now, I have to say, I did that, and I was convinced that the nurse was judging me. I was convinced that she thought I was a horrible mother. Now, she did not say that. Those were the words going around in my mind. And that night, he was in this wonderful hospital. He had very capable nurses, and our hotel was right across the street. I was 5 minutes away, but still, and sometimes we have to, the guilt is going to come up, but it doesn't have to stop us. And again, I had to start considering this more of a marathon, and how could I sustain this pace for the long haul. And this long haul has turned out to be, the better part of 10 years now, but it's not, we deal with different issues now than we did it during hospitalization.
All right. Now let me switch to your health.
Yes.
Something kind of went wonky with you.
Totally not fair, right? It's just wrong. And that was my comment to God. My prayer was, enough. Okay, come on. You have to be kidding. But yeah, I was, I have to think about how old I am, because I was diagnosed 5 years ago.
And that's not required to share on the air.
You notice I did not volunteer that. I'm old enough.
old enough.
Yeah, 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with a low-grade we're big on the low-grade cancers here in our family. Hopefully, I mean, that's a good thing. A low-grade breast cancer.
Yeah, if you got to pick one, I mean.
Yeah, that's what one of my closest friends said. Well, you know, it's a good cancer, you know. She didn't say it's a good cancer. She said it's a training wheels cancer. She was joking. She was trying to get me to laugh. And I was like, yeah, it's a training wheels cancer.
Did it work?
No. Later. That's a good line. That's going in the book. So I ended up because of just, you know, again, and I don't want to say this like, oh, all women who have this cancer should have this treatment, because I am the last person who's going to tell anybody how they should treat their cancers, because that sort of certainty was wrung out of me very early in Mason's journey. I don't know what anybody else should do. I ended up getting a double mastectomy because of a lot of good reasons for me. But I don't know what – I support women in doing what is right for them. That is what I think they should do, and get all the and feel good about it, you know, feel like feel good about their doctors and whatnot. So I had a very, very – I had a minor cancer and a very major, very difficult surgery. And that was another surrender, and that was another God, enough already, you know. But what's happened to me, you know, I think that around that point, what got wrung out of me was the question, why?
Yeah, it's kind of a Gracie and I have talked about that a lot. It's kind of a foolish question in some respects. We all ask it, but there comes to be a point when you think, okay, what's he going to tell me that's going to make me smack my forehead and say, okay, I feel better now that I know why? It's not really the question our soul is crying out for.
Yeah. Yeah, wanting to be cared for? Just to
be
loved?
Yeah, we do. We just don't want to be alone. We want to be loved. We want to know that assurance that we are loved and that we're cared for. And that's a good word. Was Mason in the hospital when this happened in Texas, or were you back home?
No, we were back home for a while. Now, Mason had that brain injury. It was classified as a traumatic brain injury, this massive bleed in his brain. And he was still rehabbing. So he wasn't quite on he's just had a different journey in life. You know, I've learned one's not more valuable than the other. He's just on a different path, as I keep saying. So he was in high school, actually, when that happened. And which is also, talk about a miracle, he was in high school. And he actually went to the prom while I was rehabbing at home. My husband drove him because he can't drive.
Well, that is awesome.
That's awesome, though. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was,
What about your other kids during this, the other two,
during
all this?
They're amazing people. And I like to say, I would have wanted them to learn empathy and compassion from a safer distance from actual tragedy and scariness, right?
Well put.
I wasn't in charge of that either. They sacrificed. When I was away, they sacrificed me being here. Now, we tried really, really hard with our extended family to fill in, but you know, there's nothing like mom and dad. So, but the good on the good news, I like to focus on the good news of that is my son Austin and my daughter Sarah are amazing people, and they have this depth that comes from having walked through really hard times. So, you know, still today, you know, they show up, they help out their brother. Mason's been having a rough go lately, and they are just really present with him, which is. Talk about if I have my eyes on that miracle, I have no doubt that we're being cared for, and there's so much good in this world.
Mm. That's got to be deeply rewarding to you. I look at my sons, and Gracie and I both have kind of like, there's so many visits to the hospital, so many nights when they had to be shipped off to be with grandparents and things such as that, and they've literally carried their mother on their back. At times, and they're fine, strong young men who we are most grateful for. And I'm like you. I would have preferred. I wanted them to be empathetic, but I would have preferred them to do it from a much safer distance.
Yeah.
And yet this is the journey. And I like to hear what's going on with the other siblings involved. because they have their own journey too. They didn't ask for this any more than their wounded sibling did, mm-hmm. you know. And so they have to adjust to this. And it sounds like you and your family have had some very frank conversations around the kitchen table.
I think that's essential. I think that, you know, what was one of the beautiful things, I've praised our medical team at Stanford, and our neuro-oncologist was very, one of our first meetings with him, he talked about the importance of being honest and age-appropriate. So we had good counsel from the start, and I think that's just essential.
Now, that was with Mason's stuff. What about your stuff?
Well, Mason has the ears of an elephant, let me just say. There was nothing, nobody was going to be keeping any secrets around here. But by that time, Sarah was in middle school, Austin was in high school, Mason was in high school. And, you know, Mason's response, I remember we brought everybody together when we got this information, and I said, I'm going to have this surgery. This cancer is, the doctor does not think it's going to kill me. It's very curable. And this is what I'm going to go through. And he said he would sit with me in the hospital, which brings tears to my eyes. He said, I'll be with you in the hospital, Mom. And Austin and Sarah just hugged me. And, you know, again, they helped. They're really good. You know, I like to talk about faith being a muscle, and that the demonstration of, and love is a muscle too, right? We're doing, and they do. They really do. They will help out, you know, bring food. They're just, their presence was so wonderful.
Now, have either of them gotten married?
Not yet. Nope. Okay. Yeah.
That'll be an interesting moment when they take all that you and your husband have invested in them into another relationship. And that will be a very interesting and moving moment for you.
And, yeah.
I could say that from personal experience when our oldest son got married, and now they're expecting their third child.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it's hard. I know, looking at me, it's easy to believe I'm a grandfather. Looking at Gracie, it's hard to believe she's a grandmother. But the years have been,
those brownie points, aren't you, bud?
The years have not been kind to me. But
it's hard on us caretakers.
I watched Parker deal with that, and I think I want you, when that moment happens, I hope you'll remember this conversation, then come back on the show and talk about it when you see how they engage with their significant other when that person comes into their life, and they build that relationship and they bring all that your family has dealt with, and then they're bringing someone else into that world, and it's hard to describe unless you've been there, and you will be there very shortly, I would imagine.
And you talked about like faith being a muscle or love being a muscle, and you know, Peter's children, really, the only way you build a muscle is you lift heavy things.
Yep. Right.
And they've lifted an awful lot of heavy things.
And it sounds like Sarah and Austin have as well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's going to be a real.
And we hate that.
They're going to be ripped going into marriage.
We hate that for them. But at the same time, we don't hate what they've become because of it.
Exactly. And, well said.
And so we just have to trust God. I told somebody the other day about, you know, they were saying I'm a pianist. They said, we love the way you play the piano and this and this. And I said, well, I love the way I play the piano now. I love the way I write and communicate. I hate how I got here. And so, you know, and I as I listen to you speak and the things that you've written, and you were a columnist and you're a commentator. I mean, you didn't just decide to write a book about this. You've been a writer for some time. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine your writing has really evolved through this process, hasn't it?
You know, it has. And one of the things that I realized is that part of it is because I just don't have the tolerance for, like, what's not true. I don't have the tolerance for a lot of superficiality anymore. It's just one of those other things that was wrung out of me. So I tend to dive pretty deep. And I like that about me, too. You know, it is a good thing.
It is so refreshing, isn't it, just to say, you know, I just don't have the tolerance for this. This is not a part of my life. I've got to cut this away. It's superfluous to me. I remember someone was telling me about, you know, the end times, and don't you think that Jesus is coming here and this and this, and look at all these signs. I said, how does that help me take care of my crippled wife today? You know, Jesus is going to have to come back when Jesus comes back. In the meantime, I've got work to do. So, you know, I just don't have that is not my mind to manage. And I think what happens with us along the way is that we start realizing, I was doing a thing the other day. Somebody asked me, said, what's the toughest thing you've ever faced as a caregiver? And here's my answer. And I want to hear your thoughts on this. My answer to them was, after 34 years of this, knowing what is mine and what is not mine to carry. That is the toughest thing that I face on a daily basis with me as a caregiver. And I've got a fairly extensive resume, but that to me is the nutshell for me, because I'm constantly overreaching on what is not mine to carry. And how does that strike you?
Oh my goodness. You should see me. If you saw me right now, my head is like a bobblehead. I'm just nodding, nodding, nodding. Yeah. And I even caught myself. I would say, well, we're having, when Mason was younger and he had chemo, it wasn't like a conscious thing. It was just, I didn't have that separation. If it was happening to his body, it was happening to me, you know? And it's understandable when your child's really young, but at some point it's been hard to make that transition to Mason as a young man and a young adult who has a lot of ideas about how his life should be, as he should, right? And wants to hear about his care and whatnot. And for me to learn to stop talking is hard for me.
Well, do you find that you have to bite your tongue and learn to like the taste of blood often?
Basically, that's it. That's it. Yeah. And inhale, I'm like, you know, like, it's, I'm not graceful with the deep cleansing breaths. They're not like subtle. It's like, oh, what's happening to that mother there hyperventilating in the corner? It's like, okay, it's okay. I'm doing this yoga thing. I don't know.
I carry my brown bag with me and just breathe into a paper bag. Well, you know, I had a friend of mine tell me something that was, it cut, but you know, the truth will set you free, but it'll piss you off first. And it's, we moved out to Southwest Montana, and our sons live back in the Southeast. And we saw our youngest son last month, and then our oldest son will be here at the end of this month, and we'll see them. COVID notwithstanding, we will see them on a fairly regular basis, but we moved out here for a lot of different reasons, but I was just kind of pining away and I really missed them. And a friend of mine told me, he said, I know you miss them, but you need them more right now than they need you.
Mm.
And I thought, ouch, darn it, that hurts. But when you've poured your soul into it, that's a hard thing. And it feels like parts of it's being kind of ripped apart, and you've got to develop a new relationship. And as you develop this new relationship with Mason, that's got to be hard for you.
Oh yeah, it's so hard, and I think it's actually probably pretty normal too, right? And that's the other thing. We can be we're on this different track, and then there's things come up that are so normal that this young man needs to individuate from his mother. Go figure, right?
Yeah, the big secret that we talk about on this show is that, you know, this is not, all the things that we talk about are not specific to caregivers, but the crucible of being a caregiver just amplifies everything. And the idea of, you know, being a parent and having to back off of your now grown children is a pretty common experience. But when you're dealing with it again in this, you know, just firebox of all of the things that we've had to deal with, it ends up, you know, feeling a lot worse than
absolutely.
It ain't pleasant. Well, listen, we are at the end of this show. And Janine, first off, I want to, where can people go to find out more about you, your books and everything else?
Okay, well, I did share I'm on Facebook, Janine Urbanic Reed, and then the book is on all of the online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The independent bookstores should have it too. It's called The Opposite of Certainty, and you can find me at theoppositeofcertainty.com.
Are you doing an audiobook of this?
There is an audiobook available right now. It's not my voice, which is, I couldn't listen to it because it was a little weird. my words come out of someone else's voice, but she's lovely.
Did you get Samuel L. Jackson to do it? Because that, yeah,
that would be good. Nice. Darn, rat. Yeah. So, yeah, theoppositeofcertainty.com. And then you can find me on social media. I post updates about Mason and pictures of our goofy pets and all the fun stuff of life.
Well, you have become a real treasure and friend to this show. And I want you to know you have an open invitation, because I need to hear from your journey, and I know our listeners do as well. And thank you for opening up your heart and sharing a little bit more. And I'm glad that you're walking in a lot of healing with your own cancer issues that you've gone through and all the sobriety stuff that you had to deal with. And our best to all three of your children, your whole family. I want to hear reports. I'd love to hear follow-ups with it, okay?
It's a deal, Peter. I'd love to come back. I just enjoy this so much. Thank you.
All righty. This is Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. I hope you had a good time. We'll see you next week.